Welcome back to Counting to Five, a podcast about the United States Supreme Court. I'm Mike, your host. This is our weekly YouTube live stream. It's being broadcast live Thursday, February 1st, 2018 at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. This live stream will also be posted as an episode of the Counting to Five audio podcast. If you're watching live, please feel free to ask questions in the YouTube live chat at any time, and I will try to monitor that and periodically address any questions you have. If you have any questions, just type them in whenever, and I'll try and take a look at them. And I think that'll make things a little more interesting if I can get feedback from viewers on what they're what they would like to hear about or any specific questions. The main topic for today's live stream is a case called Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. This is probably one of the most closely watched cases of the term. It's a highly anticipated case, and it involves a baker in Colorado who refused to bake a cake for a same-sex wedding celebration. In just a few minutes, I'm going to dig into this case. But first, I want to start with just a few quick updates about developments at the Supreme Court over the last week. There were two different dates in the last week. There were some orders relating to death penalty stay applications. Now, this is a regular part of the court's work. These come up as a fairly routine matter. Every time there's an execution scheduled somewhere in the United States, it's extremely common for there to be last-minute requests to the Supreme Court to stay the execution. And there's actually an employee at the court who is in charge of keeping track of all scheduled executions in the country so that the court is aware when they're coming up and can be, you know, prepared to have people on call to deal with those. So there's these last minute petitions come in, and the normal, typical process is the application for a stay comes in the first instance to the one particular justice who's assigned to the circuit, so the geographic region of the country that the execution is coming out of. And that justice is the first to act potentially on the application. Usually these applications are then that justice will just refer it to the entire court and the entire court will rule on it. But sometimes if time is too short and in a decision needs to be made very quickly, that justice will act on their own. So the first of these two this week was on Thursday, January 25th. And this was a defendant named Vernon Madison, who is currently 67 years old and was convicted of a 1985 murder of a police officer responding to a domestic disturbance call. And he has been on death row. He actually had a series of trials because he had a trial in 1985 that was later overturned, and he was retried in 1990, then overturned again, retried finally in 1994. That was his last of his three trials, and he's been on death row, and his execution date coming up last week. And what happened is his application got to the court. Justice Thomas, who was the circuit justice for the 11th Circuit, which is where this case was coming out of, he issued a temporary stay of the execution, basically to give the full court time to rule on it. Then shortly after that, the full Supreme Court issued a stay of the execution pending the disposition of a cert petition from this Vernon Madison, the death row inmate. And there were dissents, there were no opinion, but just a one-line dissent from Justices Thomas, Alito, and Gorsuch. So they, as part of the full court, would not have granted the stay of the execution, but a majority of the court did. And what that means is this case is not, that doesn't necessarily mean that the court is going to take this case. It just means that they're going to put off the execution long enough, at least for them to consider the petition and could decide whether they want to take the case. The specific legal issue that's come up in this application is that this Vernon Madison, at this point, while in prison, he's in fairly bad health and has had multiple strokes and has suffered some fairly severe brain damage. And as a result of this brain damage, he no longer has any memory of the murder that he was convicted for. So the petition argues that to execute someone who is unable to remember the crime that he's being punished for would be cruel and unusual punishments in violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. So the court is going to at least consider whether to take that case. If they choose not to take his case, if they deny his petition, then the stay will expire and the execution at that point would be able to go forward. If they grant the petition, then it'll come up and have full argument and would be argued at the Supreme Court. The stay would continue while the case is pending before the Supreme Court. One interesting thing to note is that I noted that Justice Thomas was the circuit court who initially entered a stay on his own before it went to the full court. But when it did go to the full court, he voted against staying it. He was one of the dissenters from it. And it's just interesting because it shows that there's kind of a different standard involved when a justice is acting alone. And when they're in that capacity, when they're acting alone as a circuit justice, they are typically trying to kind of predict how the full court would rule and not just taking their own opinion on the matter. So even though Justice Thomas didn't think that this case had merit to be stayed, he did stay in time, or at least to allow the full court to rule on it. So that's the first of the two. The second of the two was on Tuesday, January 30th. So this was another death penalty stay application. This time from a inmate named William Rayford. And he is 64 years old and was convicted of a 1999 murder of his ex-girlfriend. And at the time, he was actually on parole for a 1986 stabbing murder of his wife, his previous wife. So he's been on death row since 1999 for this second murder that he committed. This one, the allegations in his application and petition to the court were based on what were characterized as racially biased statements made during the sentencing proceedings in his case when he was the proceedings that led to him being sentenced to death. But what happened with this one here, this came in on Tuesday, January 30th. Justice Alito was the circuit justice for this case. Justice Alito referred the case to the full court, and the full court denied his application for a stay. There were no noted dissents. So as far as we know, again, with these kind of orders without full opinions, it's possible that justices dissent but choose not to have their dissent noted. So just because there's no noted dissents doesn't necessarily mean it's fully unanimous, but it's not unusual to see a noted dissent in one of these death cases. So it suggests at least that there were no dissents, that the court was unanimous, that this wasn't a case that warranted a stay of the death penalty. So that's what happened. So it appears the court didn't buy the argument about the racially biased statements. The state had argued basically that the defendant was stretching to construe a single ambiguous sentence as racially inflammatory when it shouldn't necessarily have been interpreted that way. That was the state's argument, and it seems the court at least didn't buy that this was necessarily a constitutionally significant case. And so no stay was entered, and later that night, William Rayford was executed, after the stay was denied, and the state was allowed to go forward with that execution. So that's just an interesting, this is again a regular part of the court's docket. And it's, this is just an example, two different cases within a week of each other and very different outcomes in the two. And, we'll have to keep an eye on the Vernon Madison case, and see if the court does, ultimately end up taking that case or whether, whether they end up, dropping that we'll see. So the only other piece of news I wanted to briefly mention this week is the State of the Union. So this Tuesday, the 30th, January 30th, was the State of the Union. Some Supreme Court justices are typically in attendance. This year, there were four justices attending, which is a little low compared to some recent years, but it's certainly not unprecedented. It's not unusual for many of the justices to skip the State of the Union. The different justices have, different views on whether, it makes sense for the court to be involved in the State of the Union. A number of justices have made public comments, saying that because it's such a, political event and a politically, divisive event, that it isn't really appropriate and justices are better off not going to it. And, Justices Thomas and Alito have taken that position and have stopped attending, even though each of them attended in earlier years, but they both stopped attending completely. And again, we're not there this year. Justice Scalia, before his death, had taken the same approach. and the Chief Justice Roberts has made similar comments saying that he felt that it was possibly too political and maybe didn't make sense for the justices to attend, but he has continued to attend. He's been there every or just about every year, along with Justice Breyer. He's one of the justices who is pretty much always in attendance. And Justice Breyer was actually the only justice that attended for several years in the early 2000s. So he's a regular attendee. But this year there were, just four, and it was Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Breyer, and Justices Kagan and Gorsuch were the four that were there. In the past, there have been some controversies related to the justices' appearances at the court. In 2010, President Obama, as part of his State of the Union address, criticized the court's very recent decision in the Citizens United case. And Justice Alito, who was in attendance that year, was caught on camera apparently mouthing the words "not true," referring to President Obama's characterization of the Citizens United opinion. And he got a bit of criticism in the press for kind of that reaction. And Justice Alito has responded by that was the last State of the Union he attended. Since then, he's decided to steer clear of it. It's kind of an uncomfortable position for judges who are supposed to be remaining neutral in such a highly political context, where there's frequent applause and standing ovations, where the justices are need to kind of figure out when they should be politely applauding just a general uncontroversial patriotic statement or something like that, and when they need to be sitting silently to kind of avoid taking sides. There's also been a little bit of humor related to the justices' appearances at the State of the Union. This year, Justice Gorsuch was notable for his stone-faced expression. He was apparently just making a real effort to show no emotion and keep it just a poker face. Even when President Trump directly referred to him, referring to the great new Supreme Court justice, Gorsuch was showing no reaction. In previous years, in past years, Justice Ginsburg has been caught on camera nodding off during a couple of President Obama's State of the Union speeches, falling asleep a little during the speech, and that has gotten a little bit of just humorous attention in the past. This year, there was a lot of attention to Justice Ginsburg skipping the State of the Union. It was reported prior to the State of the Union that she would not be there, and this was widely attributed to her dislike for her known dislike for President Trump. She herself noted that she had out-of-town speaking engagements that were scheduled before the State of the Union date was announced. So she already had engagements on her calendar before then. But she does have a long history and a pattern of attending State of the Unions only under Democratic presidents. She was appointed by President Clinton and attended most of President Clinton's State of the Unions, but didn't attend a single State of the Union under President Bush. And then again, attended every State of the Union under President Obama, but now has skipped the President Trump's first State of the Union. So she has kind of a very clear pattern of only attending under Democratic presidents. So far, that kind of a pattern of strictly partisan attendance seems to be unique to Justice Ginsburg among all of the justices. So that's about it for news for the week. So now let's dive into the main topic of tonight's live stream. And that's this case, Masterpiece Cake Shop v. Colorado Civil Rights Commission. And I'll start by just running through the facts, and then we'll kind of dig into some of the legal issues. And again, if you have any questions, please ask them at any time in the live chat, and that'll just help me know if there's specific angles or aspects of the case that people are interested in hearing about. So the case, the main, I guess, characters in this drama here are Jack Phillips. And Jack Phillips is the owner and a cake baker at Masterpiece Cake Shop. He's a conservative Christian. He doesn't make certain types of cakes in his cake shop due to his because he believes they conflict with his religious beliefs, and this includes he doesn't make cakes that celebrate Halloween. He doesn't make any cakes that celebrate a divorce. He won't make anything with vulgar or profane language on it. So he does restrict the types of cakes he makes based on his personal religious beliefs. He also considers himself to be an artist, and that's been apparent in the designs and logos and things of his shop. This Masterpiece Cake Shop, his logo includes a painter's palette and paintbrush, and he refers to himself as a cake artist. Now the other characters in this case are a couple named Charlie Craig and David Mullins, and they are a gay couple who had been referred to Masterpiece Cake Shop by a wedding planner. They went to the cake shop to ask about a wedding cake, but when they told and they spoke with Jack Phillips, when they told him that the cake was for them, for their same-sex wedding, Phillips said he wouldn't make them a cake. He refused to make them a cake. Now, some interesting facts about this case, and I'm going to discuss in a few minutes to what degree are these facts really important or not. But the interesting facts about this particular case are that there were no discussions of the cake design. They just asked about buying a cake, and when he found out who it was for, he said he couldn't or wouldn't make a cake for a same-sex wedding without any discussion of what the cake would look like, what it would include, if there were any design elements or anything specific about the cake that conveyed a particular message. It was just the fact of the request for the cake by itself that he had objected to there. In fact, the design that they had brought and that they had intended to talk to the baker about did have a rainbow themed design to express their support for gay rights and marriage equality. And the eventual cake that they ended up getting from a different baker at a later point was a rainbow themed cake. So they did have a cake that it was in some sense, you know, had symbolic, you know, expressive, you know, elements to it. But that was not something discussed with Phillips, at the time of their, when they, spoke with him, about the cake. Another relevant fact to this, about this case is that Masterpiece Cake Shop, all of their wedding cakes are custom made. They do have, off the shelf, pastries, different types of pastries, but their wedding cakes are custom, designs. And Phillips has said that his normal practice is that when a couple orders a wedding cake, he meets with them, talks with them to learn about their wedding, their, personal things about them, and to try and incorporate these things into his design. So these are, I guess, bespoke cakes, not just ready-made, interchangeable products. That's Phillips' kind of characterization of the way he makes these cakes. Phillips has also said that he had offered to sell them, pre-made goods from his shop, or cakes for other occasions other than a wedding, but he said he would not make a, cake celebrating a wedding. So, Craig and Mullins left Masterpiece Cake Shop, and at some point they ended up filing a complaint with the Colorado Civil Rights Commission. Now, under Colorado law, sexual orientation is a protected classification under Colorado's anti-discrimination law. So they had complained that basically because of their sexual orientation, they'd been denied services that Masterpiece Cake Shop offered to straight couples, and this was a clear discrimination on in violation of Colorado law. The Colorado Civil Rights Commission agreed and found Phillips guilty of violating the anti-discrimination laws, and they entered an injunction, so an order telling Phillips that if he was going to sell basically anything that he was willing to sell to straight couples, he had to also sell to gay couples in his shop. Afterward, you know, there was a few results from this. The couple ended up getting offered when this, the rejection by Masterpiece Cake Shop hit the news, they were offered a free rainbow themed wedding cake from another local baker, and they did take them up on that offer and had that cake at their eventual wedding celebration. Phillips ended up, after this order was issued by the Civil Rights Commission, he ended up stopping his wedding cake business altogether. And according to Phillips, this cost him about 40% of his business and forced him to lay off most of his employees. So he took a significant financial hit from stopping his wedding business. So that's the basic facts. And there's the two sides have framed this case in competing ways. So according to Phillips, his argument is basically he's being forced to engage in expressive activity against his own beliefs. So he's saying that he's being, it's forced speech, compelled expression, and he's being ordered to create a unique artistic expression, and specifically expression that symbolizes the celebration of gay marriage, which is contrary to his own personal convictions. On the other hand, the Colorado and the couple, they argue that this is really just a case about equal treatment. It's about a case about not treating one class of people worse or differently than another class is treated. So I mentioned, I went through the specific facts of this case, and those facts have gotten a lot of attention, you know, especially the fact that there was no discussion of the specific cake that the couple wanted baked. But there's some question about how important those facts necessarily are to this case in the first place, because the injunction, so the order issued by the Civil Rights Commission is far broader than that limited set of facts. That injunction says that Masterpiece Cake Shop must sell gay couples sell them wedding cakes or any product Masterpiece would sell to heterosexual couples. And that potentially, depending on how exactly that's interpreted, could even include, you know, it's right in this case, we were, since there was no, cake that was requested, his refusal seemed to apply even to just a purely, a plain or just a decorative cake that didn't have any, obvious, message relating to gay marriage on the face of the cake. But it seems that the injunction would also apply to things that were much more a cake that had a much more explicit, message. For example, if he had sold cakes to heterosexual couples that had writing on it that says something like "God bless this marriage," then it seems by the terms of the injunction, he would have to sell a cake that said "God bless this marriage" to gay couples if they wanted a similar cake. So at least to some degree, it would apply to both. And it's not clear how this injunction applies to something like a wedding topper. If he had sold cakes that had a wedding topper showing a bride and groom, and he refused to sell a cake that had a wedding topper with two grooms, to a gay couple, would this be in violation of this injunction to sell, you know, any product that they would sell to a heterosexual couple? Because it's saying essentially it's the equivalent product. It's cake with a topper representing, you know, the celebrants in the wedding, and he provided that for one and refused to provide for the other, or would you say, well, it's a different topper. He's willing to sell a male and female topper to anyone that wants one, not willing to sell a two males to anyone. That seems like a kind of an artificial distinction, but it's, you know, you could argue that either way on just the wording of the injunction. So that issue is still kind of out there. The injunction is potentially, depending how you interpret it, could be fairly broad. But beyond just the injunction, the Supreme Court, and this is true of, you know, many, many cases that the Supreme Court hears, whatever rule the Supreme Court settles on in this case is not going to just apply to this one case. It's going to govern many cases. They're going to have different sets of facts, different specific requests, different designs that are involved, and not just cakes. There's been other services, usually wedding-related services. This has been kind of the focal point of these types of cases where you've had this conflict between people's usually religious-based objections and anti-discrimination law have come in these wedding-related cases. You have cake baker cases like this one, but also cases about wedding photographers and wedding florists providing flower arrangements for weddings. Those have been there have been other cases out there. There haven't been an enormous number of these cases, but there have been enough that they've popped up in different parts of the country and here and there, and they tend to get a lot of attention every place they do. But in absolute numbers, it's not clear that there's a huge number of these cases. So that's the kind of the facts, basically. But now I'm going to briefly just touch on the legal theories that are at issue here in the case. And, Masterpiece Cake Shop, Jack Phillips, brings, two major, theories, of why he says that this anti-discrimination law, as applied to him and as applied to, his rejection or refusal to make cakes for these gay, marriage, celebrations, why this, it's unconstitutional as applied to him. And the first is, a religious, free exercise claim. So under the First Amendment, the right to free exercise of religion. And this theory it's the framing in a lot of, popular press coverage of this case has mentioned many times as a conflict between religious free exercise and anti-discrimination law. I'll explain in a moment this is not the problem, unlikely to be the main theory that this case plays out on under, and I'll explain why in a moment. But Phillips basically argues that he has a deeply held religious belief and that the application of this law requires him to violate this deeply held belief. And therefore that violates his rights to free exercise. Excuse me one moment. The one big obstacle to that argument is a 1990 case called Employment Division v. Smith. And this was a case that established a rule under the Free Exercise Clause that the court said that neutral laws of general applicability, in other words, laws that aren't specifically targeting religion or religious practice, but just neutral laws that apply to everyone, those kind of neutral laws don't violate the Free Exercise Clause, even if they, in a particular circumstance, conflict with someone's religious views. So the argument there, that particular case involved federal laws banning the use of peyote and members of a Native American church who used peyote in some of their worship ceremonies. And the court said that if a law is not targeting a specific religion or religious practice, but it's just applied to everyone, and those religious beliefs just happen to come into conflict with the law, then the law does not have to give way. And there's no claim under the Free Exercise Clause. Now, following Employment Division v. Smith, at the time it was a very controversial case, and it was actually, that's a case written, the majority opinion was written by Justice Scalia, who was a strong proponent of that view that neutral laws were not, the Free Exercise Clause did not entitle you to a, exceptions from a neutral law. Following that, Congress passed something called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is called RFRA for short, R-F-R-A, pronounced RFRA. And that was a law that, as a matter of federal law, provided certain religious exemptions from generally applicable laws that had an impact on certain people's religious beliefs or practices. And that's the law that was at issue, for example, in the Hobby Lobby Supreme Court case about the contraceptive mandate from a few years ago. However, that's RFRA kind of provides some protections for free exercise that the earlier decision in Employment Division v. Smith doesn't provide as a matter of constitutional law. RFRA provides as a matter of statutory law. However, RFRA applies only to the federal law, not to state law. So here, since we're talking about Colorado's anti-discrimination law, RFRA doesn't provide any protection. Now, many states have state RFRAs. They have their own state law that is modeled or similar to, provides a similar function to the federal RFRA. And those state laws often provide, certain protections for religious exercise that go beyond what the First Amendment provides. But Colorado is not one of those states that has one of those, so that's not an issue in the case. So, there are arguments about why this case gets around Employment Division v. Smith and still has a viable free exercise claim, but most commentators view those as harder arguments for Masterpiece Cake Shop and unlikely grounds that the court is going to decide on. So most of the attention has been on the second theory. And the second theory is a free speech theory, and specifically the First Amendment's protection against compelled speech. And the basic idea behind this is that the government, just as the government can't prohibit you, the First Amendment provides a protection against the government prohibiting people from saying certain things. The government can't prescribe certain opinions or viewpoints, say that certain viewpoints are acceptable and can be freely spoken, and contrary viewpoints are going to be suppressed. The First Amendment protects against that. Well, on the other hand, the government also can't compel someone to engage in speech that person does not want to engage in. I'll talk in a few moments about some of the key precedents, the cases in that line of case. And so the argument here by Phillips is that his cake designs are a form of expression, and the First Amendment does protect a great deal of nonverbal conduct as expressive activity equivalent to speech. And that can include symbols or other symbolic actions or things like that if they convey a message or are expressive in it to a certain degree. So Phillips says that his cake designs are, in that sense, are expressive conduct protected by the First Amendment, and therefore the government can't force him to engage in that expressive conduct, expressing a message that he does not agree with. In this case, that would be expressing some sort of message of celebration toward a gay wedding. Phillips has been very clear that his action is driven by his religious beliefs. And that's been noted in some of the commentaries too, and people have asked, well, is this really a speech case? Isn't this really a case about religion? It's kind of not really a speech case because it's really just this is a religious motivation, and this is all about religious beliefs. But that's actually true of a number of very important free speech cases, especially in the compelled speech area. Some of the key Supreme Court cases in compelled speech and other speech cases were, many of them were brought by religious minorities, including Jehovah's Witnesses, who were sometimes a persecuted religious minority with beliefs that were deeply offensive to broader society. But the court upheld their right to not be forced to conform to the viewpoints that were more broadly accepted, and to be dissenters in that way. And Phillips is arguing in the same way. Even he's motivated by his religion, but his argument is a speech argument that he can be a dissenter from what he characterizes as the orthodoxy being pushed by Colorado's anti-discrimination law, an orthodoxy of equivalence between straight marriages and gay marriages, which he rejects. So I'm going to now start touching on, go a little deeper into some of the various arguments that have been made in this case. And what I find interesting, this case, there are a lot of very strong opinions on both sides of this case. Many people on both sides, those who support Jack Phillips' Masterpiece Cake Shop and those who support Craig and Mullins, the couple, and many people regard this as an obvious case. It's an obvious case on one side that this is just discriminatory treatment of people that's in violation of anti-discrimination law and clearly unacceptable. And on the other hand, this is clearly, forcing someone to engage in, compelled speech. And I think my goal, in the remainder of this, this episode, this live stream, I'm going to touch on just some of the arguments, and my goal is not to convince you that one or the other side is correct, but to show that this is a challenging case, that there are legal values, important legal values that seem to cut in both directions, and that a really absolute decision either way could potentially have very dramatic implications, but it's also hard to see a clean line to draw in the middle that would be administrable, a line that you could draw where you could figure out which cases fall on one side or the other. And one important thing when the Supreme Court or any court is trying to craft a legal rule to govern a certain type of case is if a rule is vague or involves many factors or is unclear in its application, then it can fail to provide much guidance to people in later cases, which are never going to track the specific facts of the case that went to the court in the first place down to the detail, and which differences are significant and which are not is often, in the eye of the beholder and hard to figure out. So one of the questions, when the court is kind of getting into an area where it's not clear that there's a lot of settled law, it'll be important to see when the court eventually rules in this case, how clear of a rule they're able to lay down and what its application, looks like it will be to later cases. It seems like, whatever rule comes down will almost inevitably require some sort of difficult line drawing. It seems unlikely that the court's going to come down on a very extreme case on either side. Let me touch on that really, really quickly about why some of the seemingly easy, obvious, easy answers, may kind of go too far. So on the one hand, the argument has been made by the supporters of Craig and Mullins that basically, non-discrimination laws have routinely applied to various forms of commercial transactions and business. And the simple answer is just, look, when someone's engaged in commercial activities, then they are bound by these non-discrimination rules, and how they treat one group, they have to treat another, and that's that, right? But that kind of absolute position that doesn't take any account of the free expression part of the expressive speech or activity part of it, leaves the question of what about commercial activity that is the, quintessential, protected First Amendment activity. For example, freelance writers or, poets or musicians who do work on commission. Those are just the prototypical protected, you know, speech, activities. And they're also activities where we expect or it seems, clear that people obviously or often are very personally invested. A musician or a poet or a writer may be personally invested in the content of what they write and kind of feel, very bound up or connected with the words that they're actually putting out, as their artistic product. So here's just a couple quick examples. And it's interesting if you are on this side that thinks this should be an easy case about non-discrimination in any commercial transaction. Here's an example. So there are, musicians who provide, custom songs. So you can hire people and pay them to write a custom song for you. And a very popular type of song is a wedding song, often for for example, the bride and groom's, first dance at the wedding reception. And if you just do a quick Google search, you can find just dozens and dozens of these, just different, websites of musicians who advertise their services in writing custom songs. And they very often specifically advertise wedding songs. And if you click through some of these and poke around, you find repeatedly, this is a pretty, well-established business now of, musicians who will, talk to people, learn about the couple, learn about details about their lives or their relationship or how they met or other, you know, interesting things about their wedding or their courtship or whatever, and write a original custom song for them. In some cases, depending on the geography, even, perform live at the wedding. So that someone might have a wedding reception and have the singer-songwriter there, maybe with an acoustic guitar or whatever, playing an original ballad, about the couple as they come out for their first, dance. And so the question is, you know, there, it seems like this is, you know, again, this is kind of quintessential protected First Amendment expression. Someone using their artistic talents to create an original work of art. And the question is, in that kind of context, is there no First Amendment protection against someone being told, well, if you have done this kind of custom work for one class of people, you can be required by law to do it for some other class of people. You must be required to create original artistic works for someone, even if it violates your own beliefs in doing so. So that's kind of an example that seems on the extreme end. Some people have bit the bullet on that and said, well, in that circumstance, even in that circumstance, the singer-songwriter should be forced to write the song. If they'll write songs for straight couples for their weddings, they should be forced to write the song for a gay wedding. So you can take that position. Intuition behind that is people don't really expect these kind of anti-discrimination provisions to be applied very often to these quintessentially creative positions like freelance writers. It seems unlikely that many freelance writers are going to be in a situation where they're commissioned to write something that's similar enough to what they've written for, you know, one group, that another group has a claim that they are denying equal treatment under anti-discrimination laws. But it's hard to say. But so here's another example that comes a little closer to the Masterpiece Cake Shop. Masterpiece Cake Shop, we were just talking about a baker making a cake that would then later be used at the wedding reception. But here's another, and this is a an example, but this actually exists. And if you, again, Google this, you can find this out there in the real world. But due to the popularity of these baking television shows where you see people baking these fancy, elaborate wedding cakes in real time, competing against each other and with these elaborate designs, there are cake bakeries who advertise a service where they will actually create or prepare a cake live at a wedding reception. So show up and starting with just a plain unadorned like tiered wedding cake, and then over the course of a few hours at the wedding reception transform it into some elaborate fancy cake, often based on certain themes or interests of the couple, so that the attendees at the wedding can actually see it in real time. So suppose someone wanted to hire one of those companies to bake a cake at their wedding reception, and it was a gay wedding, and they wanted the cake to feature themes that were associated with gay marriage, marriage equality, or rainbow flag type things, or whatever. Then you have a situation there where you would have the baker actually compelled to in front of a gathering of 100 or several hundred people to create an artistic creation, an original unique creation in front of a crowd of people at a public place, in the context of a ritual ceremony, that was something that they had strong disagreement with. And it seems again there that there does seem to be, the type of protections of conscience that are are at issue in the compelled speech cases seem like it seems like you're forcing the kind of, conforming to someone else's views that was protected against in those cases. So the question is, if that's too far, then where do you draw the line between that and Masterpiece Cake Shop? On the other side, the Masterpiece Cake Shop, has argued, and supporters of Masterpiece Cake Shop have taken a pretty broad view of the protections that should be provided for the exercise of someone's First Amendment rights, the right to refuse to convey a message that someone disagrees with. But that runs into the question very quickly of how much expression is enough to qualify as something that someone can refuse to convey. So the simplest example is a birthday cake, just a common simple cake. Someone writes happy birthday on it. And you could say the person sells cakes every single day, and there's hundreds of cakes, and they all look identical and have the words happy birthday written on the top. But that is speech. Happy birthday is a speech. It's an expression, of an idea. And could someone say that a cake saying happy birthday conveys a message of celebration toward the person who the cake is directed to? And if they believe that the particular person is someone not worthy of celebration, for one reason or another, could they refuse to, create that birthday cake? That seems, fairly extreme. And that at least is a cake that has, a verbal expression that's recognized as a verbal expression. And a question, and this is something that came up at the oral arguments in this case. There's a lot of artistic activities, that you might question whether they should be considered expressive. Now, people have argued that this cake, especially if it's just a wedding cake without a explicit message, doesn't have a rainbow flag on it or anything like that. It just has, decorations that don't necessarily convey any obvious message. What about a makeup artist or a hairstylist that's going to do the you know, the hairstyles and things for the wedding party at a wedding? It is artistic, but can it be said to convey any message? Now, the argument on wedding cakes is wedding cakes are different. Wedding cakes are distinctive. They belong to a particular context, a particular type of ceremony. So that by itself, kind of makes them a class by themselves, and they convey, a celebratory message about the wedding. It's tough to see a clear line of how much expression is enough expression. And, the concern is if you go too far, then you could be completely gutting, anti-discrimination law. The example that comes up over and over again is interracial marriage, which, you know, at a time, half a century ago was still extremely controversial in certain parts of the country. There were people who expressed religious-based opposition to interracial marriages. And you could, picture the same exact arguments that are being made in this Masterpiece Cake Shop, case, but made, opposing a cake that was, intended to celebrate an interracial marriage. It seems like it's a complete, parallel. It's hard to, distinguish one from another. There have been arguments that have been made why it should be distinguished, and these typically are based on the, extent of the level of discrimination that was experienced at the time when interracial marriage was a live issue that was being fought out in the courts, versus right now where, the gay marriage is very much ascendant and there are huge numbers of vendors that are more than willing to provide cakes for those type of events. This case, I've only scratched the surface on this. There's so much more to this, and there's so many different angles to this. I'm just so this doesn't run too long, I'm probably going to wrap up fairly soon. But there is really a lot more to this case, and I could follow up with another podcast episode touching on more of these themes later if there is any interest. So I am interested in any comments that people have or other questions about this. But one more major theme, that came up repeatedly in the briefs and was also raised at oral argument, is the question of how do you distinguish between discrimination against a person or a identity versus discrimination against a message? That comes up in the framing here where, the couple and the Colorado Civil Rights Commission say, well, this is clearly just an identity-based discrimination. He serves straight couples. He doesn't serve gay couples. So that's clear, just discrimination on the basis of their sexual orientation. Where Phillips says it's about the message. He says that the message that's being conveyed is celebration of what he describes as a traditional marriage or something like that, but opposite sex marriage versus a message that celebrates same-sex marriage, which he says are, you know, these are two distinct messages. And it's the message that he objects to. And his argument is he's perfectly willing to serve, gay people in his shop to sell them off the shelf, cakes, to make custom cakes for non-wedding events. But it's the wedding and it's the message of celebrating a wedding that he objects to. So that's his argument. There are some arguments have been made that even if it's the same, functionally the same cake at two different weddings, a straight wedding and a gay wedding, sometimes the context makes a huge, huge difference in what a message actually conveys. You could imagine a speaker who's hired as an MC for a political rally, who says something to the effect of, this candidate is the right choice for America's future. Could that candidate then, be required at a political rally for the opposite party, for the opposing party, to make that same statement. This candidate is the right choice for America's future. Obviously, the content in the context, the reference to this candidate means something very different, but it's the same expression. And in fact, in some jurisdictions in the United States, it's very much a minority view, but there are some notable jurisdictions, including Washington, D.C., where political affiliation is a protected classification under anti-discrimination law. And you cannot discriminate on the basis of someone's political affiliation in serving them. So under an interpretation where even expressive activity can be required to be delivered in a non-discriminatory fashion, that does raise the question. If we bring it back to a religious context, which again often drives these type of cases, because sometimes the people who are most willing to take a very strong stand about just simple expressions of verbal expressions or statements are people who have some sort of, you know, religious conviction in avoiding bearing false witness or blasphemy or other, you know, types of prohibitions that come from their religious beliefs. But suppose someone were to hired to bake a cake decorate a cake for a religious celebration or religious event that was for by their co-religionists. Perhaps they belong to a particular religious sect that has its own, you know, particular distinctive beliefs. And someone asks for a cake that had the phrase "Our God is the one true God" on the cake. Would that require them to be willing to place that exact same message on cakes for any other religious group that wanted to come in, or else they'd be engaging in religious discrimination? Now, for many highly religious people, placing that statement on a cake that's intended for a celebration of some other religion would be extremely blasphemous and just a violation of their core religious beliefs. But that could be the implication of a broad rule that says, well, if the message is going to be conveyed, the same message conveyed to one group versus another group, then that's just discrimination based on the person, not on the message, and can be prohibited. And there's also the point that message and identity are often tightly intertwined. It's sometimes hard to draw a distinction between objecting to something because of the message it conveys and objecting to the people who are delivering that message. That it's a difficult line to draw. I'm going to wrap this up. I had a lot more angles and directions I could go on this case. It's a rich case with so many different angles to it. And a lot more kind of, ideas of how you might distinguish, this case one way or the other, explaining why, this case should fall on one or the other side of the line, all of which are, have challenges. It's tough to find a clean line, that doesn't cause some difficult or kind of uncomfortable cases. But for purposes of time, I don't want this to run too long. I'm going to wrap it up now. But I am interested in any additional questions people have. If you have any thoughts about this case, any ideas, questions about whether certain rules or approaches could be applied by the court to this case, I'd love to hear them. You can leave a comment, either on the YouTube page or on the countingto5.com, post for this, or on Facebook. And I may, if I get any good questions or comments, or I may revisit this in a later, podcast episode. But that's going to be it for tonight. The next live stream is going to be a week from today. That's Thursday, February 8th at 9 p.m. Eastern time. Our usual weekly live stream time is going to continue to be Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, but you can always check the Counting to Five YouTube channel to see the next scheduled live stream. The court is still in recess between its January and February sittings, so we're still not expecting any major actions from the court until the next oral argument session, which starts on February 20th. Next week, in next week's live stream, I'm going to dig into another case from earlier in the term and just spend an episode kind of exploring it a bit. And this time I'm going to talk about Gill v. Whitford, which is a case out of Wisconsin about the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering. So if you have any questions about Gill v. Whitford or just general questions about partisan gerrymandering, please send them to me or you can submit them in the live chat during next week's broadcast. Also, I'd like to mention earlier this week, I posted a podcast episode previewing a case called City of Hays, Kansas v. Vote, which is going to be argued on February 20th. And that's a case about the scope of the Fifth Amendment's right against self-incrimination. That's episode 26 of the podcast. Please check that out. And I hope to do a few more episodes previewing some of the February cases before those arguments roll around. So just keep an eye out for that. If you haven't subscribed to Counting to Five, either subscribed on YouTube or subscribed to the audio podcast, please do, and I'll make sure you don't miss future episodes. And whether you're watching on YouTube or listening to the audio podcast, I would love your feedback. You can leave comments anywhere you can leave them on, or you can tweet at Counting to Five, or send an email to me at mike@countingtofive.com. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you for listening. This has been Counting to Five.